This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Before his assassination almost 40 years ago, Harvey Milk was one of the most well-known gay politicians. Though he was not the first to be openly gay in office, Harvey Milk was clear that in order to make change, the gay community had to have a seat at the table. His courage and conviction inspired a generation of out politicians who helped advance the gay rights movement. Scholar Andrew Reynolds joins us now to talk about his new book on this very topic. He's a professor of political science at UNC Chapel Hill and author of The Children of Harvey Milk, How LGBTQ Politicians Changed the World. Andy, welcome back. Good to have you back.
Thank you so much.
Remind us who Harvey Milk was.
So Harvey Milk was the sort of iconic San Francisco politician who, after a number of tries, ultimately was elected to the San Francisco Board of Supervisors as not the first out elected official, but certainly the most visible and sort of iconic person to break that barrier.
Now, talk about what was happening at the time in terms of the politics, the district that he represented, and what was going on in San Francisco at the time.
So, I mean, I think the gay rights movement was emerging and getting stronger, but it was very focused on that Castro area of San Francisco. At the time, initially, elections were at large. So it was very tough for a sort of insurgent candidate like Harvey Milk to be elected. But then they changed the election system and made it ward-based. So suddenly you had a district that was really likely to elect an out candidate. And that's when Harvey finally succeeded and was this iconic figure that created headlines around the world.
You talked to a number of openly gay politicians for this book, the people who have followed him. What's their understanding? And was there a common thread for you in what you heard in those interviews?
Yeah, I think around the world, there's a very resonant story of people who believe that they need to make a difference by being visible, by coming out as gay or lesbians or bisexual or transgender political leaders, facing huge hurdles, whether they're in the Netherlands or in Britain or in South America or America, they're making inroads into a society that is traditionally, you know, very homophobic or transphobic. But ultimately, they succeed. And they succeed because they outwork their opponents, but also because they latch on to some sort of zeitgeist where people believe that finally LGBT people should have a place at the table.
And this visibility is very important. And you say in some ways distinguishes the gay rights movement from other civil rights movements in the U.S.
Yeah, I think the interesting thing about the LGBTQ political movement is that we have seen marginalized communities in our societies for centuries. There are African Americans, there are Latinos. Women are there and we know they're there. And they may be discriminated against and often are. But the thing about the LGBTQ movement is that we didn't know they were there. People were hiding. They were in the closet. Lesbian and gay and bisexual and trans people have always been there, but they were invisible. So as relatives and leaders and entertainment figures begin to come out, you suddenly feel this jarring reality that you always knew those people. They were your friends, they were your relatives, they were your colleagues, but now they're sitting next to you. And I think that's why perhaps there's a big impact about the visibility of that movement.
And it's so important. I mean, it's interesting to watch the evolution of movements like that. We'll stick with the LGBTQ rights movement and Harvey Milk's moment as he runs for and wins to on the Board of Supervisors. He's very conscious of representing the rights of LGBTQ people. In other words, assimilation and normalization is the goal. But you start out by saying, no, we have to represent this group of people who have been marginalized. We didn't do it, but here we are. And I'm going to represent the interest of those people as an out gay man.
Yeah, at the end of the day, a lot of these lesbian and gay leaders have embraced their visible role as representatives of a community. I mean, mostly they say we are not the only voice in the community, but we need to have that community at the table. And some of them struggle to sort of escape that hyphen labeling. You know, Barney Frank for many years didn't want to be the gay politician. He wanted to be a politician. But at the same time, he and others inevitably are the one voice in the room for that community that, you know, is struggling in a whole variety of ways. And so I think the more successful LGBT politicians have at the same time said, we're about the environment, we're about public housing, we're about the economy, but at the same time, we are a voice for this community that you have long overlooked and discriminated against.
Think about the parallels, too. If you think about Jesse Jackson running as the third party candidate, right, so specifically representing the interests of African Americans, Barack Obama, successful in his campaign, is very clear that I do not represent only the interest of Africa. And yet his visibility on that stage was powerful.
Right. And it's a temporal issue. I mean, the state of grace would be when no one cares about sexual orientation or gender identity, that we do not see a gay politician, a gay mayor, a gay council member. We just see a council member. But until you get to that point, that state of grace where it drops out of our equation in our mind, then they do have to stand up and represent. And I think America is seeing that today, where in some places, being an out politician is no longer relevant to winning or losing. It's an irrelevance to the voters. But in most places, it is still relevant. In some places, it's a positive. I mean, Mark Kleinschmidt, the mayor of Chapel Hill, has long said that he was benefited by the fact that he ran as an out visible candidate. But in most places, it's still a negative, and you struggle against that stereotyping of the gay person.
And Mark Kleinschmidt is also clear when he says it was knowing that there was an out gay politician in the South that actually put him onto the mission.
Yeah, this is one of the things that I find most emotional about a lot of the stories, in that politicians, once they break through, often have this amazing role modeling capacity, power for young kids around the world and in their local town. So Mark Kleinschmidt, growing up in Fayetteville, North Carolina, as a teenager, reads a newspaper story that Joe Hartzenberg has been elected as the first openly gay man in the South. And Mark Kleinschmidt says, I need to go there. I need to go to Chapel Hill, where I'm going to be welcomed and accepted for who I am. And he ultimately becomes Chapel Hill's mayor for 3 terms and a significant political figure. And I think those breakthroughs, Harvey Milk's breakthrough, communicate far beyond their hometown. They say to kids everywhere that you're valid, you can be a leader, and you don't need to listen to the people who put you down.
And Harvey Milk was very conscious of this in his time when he made that movement what it was.
2 days after I was elected, I got a phone call. And the voice was quite young. It was from Altoona, Pennsylvania. And the person said, thanks. And you've got to elect gay people so that that young child and the thousands upon thousands like that child know that there's hope for a better world.
It's Harvey Milk, an openly gay man who ran and won a seat on the San Francisco Board of Supervisors in 1978. Talking with Andy Reynolds, who teaches political science at UNC Chapel Hill. His new book, The Children of Harvey Milk, How LGBTQ Politicians Changed the World. You do a whole chapter on politics in the South, gay politics in the South, and there's a lot of North Carolina in there.
Yeah, I think the interesting thing about Carolina is that it's sort of the fault line of progressive politics and old politics, in that whilst we've seen, you know, huge attacks upon the LGBT community, at the same time, the state has given us some of the most iconic leaders of the LGBT political world, all the way back to Pauli Murray in sort of the mid-20th century. But now we have some of the most nationally recognized LGBT leaders in the South as well. And that's one of the interesting things about our state, in that we are sort of the fault line for a lot of these debates.
And also we can see the evolution of the movement. Pauli Murray, as you mentioned, was not someone who believed that she could come out. So we know now, but she did not talk about herself as an out politician or an out scholar or an out writer or theologian and the many other things she did well.
Right. And wrestled with that identity, and also was wrestling with multiple identities, her race, her gender, her sexual orientation, her gender identity, somebody who internally is wrestling with who she is, but at the same time contributes a remarkable amount to this nation and the world when it comes to legal issues, when it becomes to scholarship, when it becomes to religious issues. So somebody who is not allowed to be who they are in public, but at the same time achieves a remarkable amount. And I think, personally, Pauli Murray is one of the most undervalued and underappreciated Americans in the 20th, 21st century. And I hope there's going to be much more celebration of her.
But again, I think what you're talking about here points to the importance of movements like this. We talk about them in terms of political movements, and that puts our minds in state and national capitals, and we think about, you know, court cases and legislation. We're talking about legislation here and a public life that influences the lives of every human being, whether or not they feel comfortable in their school, in their home, being who they are.
Yeah, I was particularly struck by the public health evidence over HB2 and the bathroom bill. You know, we were having that big general debate about the rights of trans people, whilst at the same time, it was estimated that on average each school in North Carolina had three trans or gender-variant kids within each school. And the public health indicators were that their depression rates, their anxiety, their attempted suicide rates were astronomical when this debate was happening about them. And so these local council, these Charlotte, these Triangle, these Raleigh debates have a huge impact on the person, on the individual, on the child. And so that's why I think that if we'd had more trans or any trans people in office in Carolina at that time, the debate, the tone would have been very different, because you cannot demonize and stereotype a community in the same way if they're sitting opposite you.
And that's what you say in the book, that we're really at that threshold now, probably where Harvey Milk was in 1978. That is where we are for trans communities today.
Yeah, we're starting to see the emergence of leaders, of candidates, and the very first drips of success, but really is a community that may be 56 years behind the gay rights movement.
Now, and what does it say when you talk about John Hinson in your book? This is Mississippi, 1978. And so we go back to this is when Harvey Milk wins his seat on the Board of Supervisors in San Francisco. John Hinson is a congressman from Mississippi who is not out. Tell his story, and then we'll sort of fast forward or slowly forward to Clay Aiken and talk about how much things have changed since then.
So Hinson is leading a sort of secretive gay life in D.C. and in Mississippi. Like many people in the South, he's a gay man who has to keep that under wraps because of the nature of politics and also society. He's involved in some scary episodes of trying to live his life at the same time as being a political leader in Washington. He ultimately, you know, is a very sad figure. You know, Barney Frank as well was also taking risks with his personal life when he was in the closet before he actually ultimately came out. And I think the difference to the modern era is that now we do have people who are able to embrace their identity, live openly, live more safely, live more happily, but also be political leaders within our society.
Which takes us to Clay Aiken, who did run for that in that second congressional district in North Carolina as an out gay man, albeit he had a persona as former American Idol contestant. Does that tell you that things have actually changed, or were the dynamics in that race because of his personality maybe not quite?
Yeah, so, I mean, the interesting thing with Clay is that he told me that he felt that him being gay was not a negative in his campaign. Everyone knew he was gay. You know, if you're in North Carolina, if you're in the world, everyone knows who Clay Aiken is, and everyone knows he's a gay man, and everybody embraces his personality and style. But at the end of the day, he felt what hurt him was being an entertainer, that he wasn't a credible candidate because he was a singer, because he was a reality show star, which hasn't hurt some other American politicians. But Clay felt that his sexual orientation in that district in North Carolina was no longer the thing that was his struggle. It was more that he wasn't considered credible because he was Johnny-come-lately to the political scene.
Do you agree with that? And does this mean that we have made progress?
Oh, I think we've certainly made progress in North Carolina, and we've made progress in the states. We have not reached that state of grace where it has dropped out as a factor. I think people still vote against gay candidates just because they're gay, but I think the numbers of people who do that are astronomically lower than they were in the past. And I also think that political leaders, especially Republicans, often overestimate the homophobia and transphobia in society. They may see it as a lever to be pulled to get some more votes, but it's not actually the thing that resonates with voters today in the same way.
It seems fragile. I mean, we talk about the moment when Barack Obama came out in favor of gay marriage, and when he stood up on the bully pulpit and made that announcement, it had a huge impact on the black community.
Yeah, I think one thing that is certainly true is that African Americans, especially church-going African Americans around the country, were really swayed by President Obama's signaling that he supported gay marriage. And a lot of traditional, more conservative African Americans said, well, if it's okay for Barack, it's okay for us. And that intersectionality between race and sexual orientation is very interesting because we sometimes assume that minority ethnic groups are going to be more homophobic, but that's not the case. We find that Latinos and African Americans are just as positive towards LGBT candidates as whites in America today. And we're seeing more and more people of color who are LGBT, who are representing the community as a whole.
And this seeing more is the important part and maybe an important element in that. The fact that we're seeing more normalizes that and makes it acceptable for communities that had maybe questions before.
Yeah, it's a virtuous circle. The more society is empathetic towards LGBT people, the more they're likely to vote for those candidates. The more candidates are elected, the more society becomes acclimatized to having LGBT people in leadership positions around them. So the more the situation improves, the more the laws improve, the more likely you are to be elected because you're an LGBT candidate.
But it also engenders pushback and backlash as well. And you can see how fierce it is. Certainly from the White House, the president seems to think that there is great money to be made, particularly with transgender issues, great political hay to be made.
That's true, but I would point out that it's America in many ways is idiosyncratic. The rest of the world, right of center politicians, conservative politicians, now are as likely to embrace gay rights than the left of center. Last year, we saw more conservative politicians being elected as out candidates in parliaments than left of center ones. America is idiosyncratic in that the religious right has pulled the Republicans to a position that is out of step with the rest of the world.
You're about to go on a global tour, and that suggests that, in fact, you're going to visit quite a few countries, suggesting that this issue is very important to people around the world.
Yeah, I think it's many countries are at different levels of their evolution. But, you know, if you look at a country like Ireland, their embrace of gay rights, their embrace of gay marriage, their embrace of their trans community is a signal that they want to be a new type of country. Ireland, on a number of dimensions, abortion, blasphemy, having an openly gay prime minister, Taoiseach, is saying, we are going to embrace all of our Irish children. And that's, we want to be a modern society, a modern country. So I think it's resonant whether you're sort of making huge progress or whether you're in the dark ages. It's an issue that crops up everywhere.
Andrew Reynolds, professor of political science at UNC Chapel Hill, director of the UNC LGBTQ Representation and Rights Research Initiative, and author of The Children of Harvey Milk, How LGBTQ Politicians Changed the World. Andy, thanks so much for being with us.
It's a pleasure.
You can find out more about the book at our website, stateofthings.org. Andy's going to be at Flyleaf Books in Chapel Hill on Wednesday, November 7th. It will be an open lecture with a panel discussion. And you can find out more at our website, stateofthings.org. Just ahead, musician Tish Inahosa shares reflections on nearly two decades of music, and she'll be performing live. Stay with us.